Record here. All right. Hey, we got a podcast going. All right, cool. We're up to, what are we up to? We're up to episode 7, which is kind of cool. And so far still in sequence, which is, you know, also a bit of a novelty around here. Mike is back. Mike, how you doing, man?
I'm doing good. I think I'm at the 50% mark of these podcasts this season. Not too bad.
You missed some fun at the expo, including Kevin was part of the fun at the expo. maybe next year. It was largely a good time. So got to meet and see all kinds of interesting people and folks that want to know what all went on. Just listen to last week's podcast. We got all kinds of folks on there. And then our buddy Kevin from Fort Circle Games is back. Kevin, how's it going?
It is going amazing. I'm thrilled to be here, sir.
So last year from the expo, you and Jason disappeared and like took a field trip up to Donner Pass from Reno. Did you guys sneak out and get any interesting field trips in from Louisville this time around?
No. And by the way, that trip to Donner Pass was awesome because we had lunch there too. And I had the mystery meat and it was fantastic. Tasted a little bit like chicken. So unfortunately, in Louisville, we wanted to go to the Colonel Sanders museum, but it turns out that's like a 2.5 hour drive each way. So I think we're going to go next year with a little bit better scheduling. So we actually didn't see anything historic, which is normally our modus operandi for these kind of events. So we got the lay of the land instead. And, you know, Jason's on the board of Gamma. So he's got more demands on his time than he did in the past. So,
yeah. So 30 minutes south, you could go cruise past Fort Knox. You could go admire the gold depository from a distance, but the Patton Museum is also there if you want to go see a bunch of old tanks.
Oh, that would have been cool. Maybe we'll try to do both. I think we might drive next year so we can go to the Colonel Sanders Museum, but then, you know, that would make sense. So go out a day early.
Yeah. The Patton Museum is not that far away. It's not an interstate getting down there, but it's not hard to get to, and it's right on the highway, and you don't have to get permission to get on base to go to the museum either. It's accessible from folks off the post.
That's
the way they've got the parking lots and the fences and everything arranged. You can get to it without getting onto the base.
Yeah. You know, 9/11 ruined so many things. I grew up in Sierra Vista, Arizona, which is next to Fort Huachuca. Yep. And as my father worked on the base, but was not in the military. And I went on the base all the time. We went bowling. We saw movies there. I saw Rambo 3 full of GIs, which is the only way to see a Rambo movie. Same with Rocky 4. Like it was awesome. And now it's like, I don't know, they're like their military base is being guarded or something. So it's definitely a change.
Yeah. So now put it on the field trip list for next year as a possibility. Never mind all the, see the challenge of taking Mike to an event in Louisville is we'll never get him out of the distilleries.
Yeah. Well, the smart thing is just don't go because then you won't have the temptation. So, I mean, to the distilleries, not to Louisville proper.
Yeah. So Mike's probably already got a checklist going for next year, don't you?
I do now.
Actually, we went to a brew pub that they brew on site. I can't remember the brew pub's name, but we were there with like folks from Queen and Arcane Wonders, a couple other companies. And it was actually a pretty good little spot. The burgers were great. Like I didn't actually have a bad meal the entire time I was in town. The last night we went to dinner with Cole and Drew Worley and had a pretty fancy meal. It was the Fat Lamb, which is my Secret Service name. So of course we had to go to that restaurant. And I was really impressed with Louisville. I got to say, I had a great time. I think it's a much better setup than Reno was for Gamma. So definitely encourage anyone in the industry to go next year.
Yeah, Reno, I'm not sure I left the building, you know, after that first day when I just made a trip to a local grocery store to make sure I had enough Dr. Pepper to get through the week. I'm not sure I left the building after that. This one, we kind of had to because the hotel they were putting the media and staff folks in was 2 blocks in the opposite direction from the Galt. The convenient. Yeah. So there was our hotel and it was a 2 to 3 block walk to the convention center. And then it was another 2 to 3 block walk in the other direction to get to the Galt where all the vendors and exhibitors and everybody were staying and a lot of the stores were staying. And that's where the game nights were. And the challenge there is not so much that it's necessarily that long of a walk. It's that at 11:30 at night when game night stuff is all wrapping up and everybody's, you know, calling it an evening. Now you got to walk 5 blocks back the other direction in downtown Louisville at night and there were more than a few unsavory characters floating around downtown. I'm sure you noticed.
Well, I think those are folks from the casino.
Maybe. So between our hotel and the convention center, there was a place there called Overdrive. It's an indoor go-kart track that also has axe throwing.
Interesting.
And so, you know, the more you describe this place, the more it sounds like a real life Mario Kart. Sort of throwing axes at your fellow go-kart drivers or something ridiculous like that. But apparently Asmodee rented the whole place out the last night for a giant party there.
We didn't get an invite. I guess it must have got lost in the mail.
Yeah. We didn't either. We strolled right on past it to grab some pizza that last night and then, you know, called it a night because everybody had to get up early Friday and drive home. We were not here to necessarily reminisce on the expo and make Mike jealous and therefore make him more likely to attend next year. We were wanting to talk to you about all things Fort Circle-ish and sort of, you know, what's coming up, what's on the horizon, how things have gone so far. You know, we'll talk about Circle DC here in a little bit also. As we are recording this, I think you've got both Votes for Women and Halls of Montezuma on a boat, probably not on the same boat, but they are on boats somewhere.
Well, Votes for Women is on a boat and Halls of Montezuma will be on a boat soon. So, I didn't want to hold Votes for Women for the Halls of Montezuma because there had been a couple little production things that we needed to iron out. And so it didn't make sense to hold it. So, and it wasn't that big of a difference in price, but certainly, you know, getting Votes for Women in people's hands 3 weeks earlier is certainly, certainly more valuable to me. So, the thing is, so I'm not sure if you remember, but there had been a little kerfuffle with Facebook about some ads for Votes for Women. And that actually was the best thing that could have happened to us. I should probably send Mark Zuckerberg a fruit basket because it called a lot of attention to the campaign. And so we had about 2,000 or 2,100 backers who were new to us. And so, you know, we want to make sure they get their first game in a real timely fashion. And so let's get Votes and Women in their hands so they can be impressed with what we do.
Yeah. I don't want to sound like a bit. I'm just curious, like, of those 2,100 new folks that were all ordering Votes for Women, like, I may end up showing up as a new person because I ordered one of these. I didn't back it the first time around because I had other stuff I was backing. I made sure to grab one this time around because I wasn't sure how soon you were going to get around to a third printing at some point.
Well, there's new to Kickstarter and then they're new to, right? Like there are people who've bought Shores of Tripoli down the road but they didn't back it on the Kickstarter. So technically they're new to us as a Kickstarter backer, but they're not new to us. So,
okay.
And there was certainly some folks in that camp also. I would say the Facebook thing was accounted for about a third of the campaign though, as far as backers and money raised. So
I think it's pretty cool. As you know, look, it's the middle of March as we're recording this. As it stands right now with the expected shipping and everything else, Votes for Women within the next month and a half should be to customers probably.
I would say May for Votes for Women and then June for the Halls of Montezuma.
So that's where my question was going next was for Votes for Women should certainly be in hand well in time for Origins. Do you think Halls of Montezuma would be also?
I just always assume something bad will happen. So no.
Fair enough. So because we have both on the schedule at Origins and, you know, folks go, man, I love this game. I want to buy a copy of it. Like, we know we can send them over to Enterprise to go pick up a copy of Votes for Women. Were we going to be able to do the same for Halls of Montezuma?
I mean, I hope so, obviously. And we, you know, if I even have to do a little something extra to get Don the games he needs to have them at Origins, I would love to do that. But, you know, we can only do what's possible. We can't do what's impossible.
Yeah. Totally get it. So this is going to get 3 games in print total for you guys at the moment. Shores of Tripoli, Votes for Women, Halls of Montezuma will be the third one once we add that. What's next?
Well, so it's funny that you ask that. I have an internal numbering system which doesn't quite map to release date, but Halls, if you notice on the side of a box of Votes for Women, it has a number 1 on the side of it. And I didn't do this initially with Shores of Tripoli, but now the idea is to, you know, people want to collect them all sort of like Pokemon and so be able to have them lined up number. So the Halls of Montezuma is number 2, and then the reprint for the Shores of Tripoli will be number 3. And that reprint will happen this summer. And we add a fortress piece for Tripoli. We add a sloop piece for the Americans, and we also add a separate deck for the T-Bot, the solitaire bot, a separate deck of cards similar to Votes for Women. So it has how Votes for Women has the Oppo bot, because it's just easier for newer players to learn the solitaire system instead of with Swords of Tripoli, how now it has, you know, on the back page, it's kind of an if-then statements. Then we have the number four in the lineup is Hunt for Blackbeard, which is by Volker Runke, and he will have that at Circle DC. And that is almost as far along as Halls Montezuma. It's not quite, but almost. We are going to have prototype copies or pre-production copies at Circle DC to play. And, you know, we got need to inspect them and make sure they're good before we, you know, go full on production with those. But that's actually a pretty fantastic game. As I said, it's by Volker Runke. It is a hidden movement where one player is Blackbeard and the other player is the Royal Navy. Of course, the Royal Navy wants to find Blackbeard. Blackbeard wants to not be found, but he also has to still, you know, keep his crew happy and do some pirating. And so it's a really pretty interesting game. GMT was originally going to publish it, but Volker just decided it wasn't good with as a solitary game. I mean, it's a deduction game and those really aren't great solo. So GMT passed over to us. And frankly, I'm super thrilled to be publishing that. The fifth game in our lineup, which will be published in June, which there's not a Kickstarter for, but we will make available after it's delivered, is Shakespeare's First Folio. It's definitely our lightest game. It's a co-design between me and my wife on putting together Shakespeare's First Folio, Your Rival Printers. It's a little more of a Euro game than we would normally publish, but I'm pretty thrilled with it. And as I said, we partner with the Folger Shakespeare Library, and so they've been providing lots of historical documents, lots of background. And, you know, that's a game that I think, you know, you might see in a bookstore or in a Barnes & Noble, because it's got, you know, Shakespeare is an intellectual property, for lack of better terminology, that has a lot of resonance. And, you know, putting together the First Folio is a pretty exciting part of, you know, his legacy. And then we have First Monday in October, which will be our next Kickstarter campaign. Oh, no, I'm sorry. Blackbeard will be. But then we have First Monday in October, which is designed by Talia Rosen. Jason Matthews did the development work on it, and it's the history of the Supreme Court. So your rival kind of law firm slash think tanks, because it starts in 1789 and comes to current day. And so you're taking positions on different historical cases that, you know, some of them at least you'll have heard of. And you're trying to put your more favorable justices onto the bench, who will then rule your way in these cases that you're taking positions on. It's an outstanding game. This past weekend at AwesomeCon, while I was teaching Swords of Tripoli, I had several people who had been playing it come over and say that, you know, First Monday in October is the most amazing game they've seen. And actually, and so, like, I was really, like, taken aback. I was like, I like it, but wow, that's a really great response. And then a little further out, we have Night Witches, which is designed by Liz Davidson and David Thompson, both friends of the shows as well as mine. And that is in art development right now. Ian O'Toole is doing the art. And so that should be an outstanding game. You know, David Thompson, everything he touches turns to gold.
Well, is it David or is it one of the clones?
Well, you know, he's got so many, you know, I just take no position on that. Jason Matthews and I were convinced, like, he has made some kind of pact with the devil or something, because he's so wonderful. He's so nice. He's so productive. Like, no one can be that amazing. So I'm suspicious. Something's wrong there. No, I'm kidding. I met him.
He's borrowed Hermione's time turner is how he gets all this stuff done.
That could be it. I should stress we were joking. Like, he came out for Circle DC last year. He's coming out again this year, and he's just fantastic. So I can't wait to see him again. Then we have a game called Peace 1905. And this is a game actually I signed last year at Circle DC. It was the winner of the second Consum Game Jam. Maurice Suckling led a team of four designers, and it is on the peace treaty of 1905 between Russia and Japan. It is fundamentally a two-player game, but now they're adding both a one-player and three-player version. The one-player, you're Teddy Roosevelt, and trying to make sure both sides get to the table and get the treaty passed. And in fact, that's how Teddy Roosevelt won his Nobel Peace Prize. And then in the three-player game, it's the Russian ambassador, the Japanese ambassador, and Teddy Roosevelt. And Teddy wants to make sure neither side wins by too much. Of course, the Russian and Japanese ambassador want as much as they can get for their country. And so it's a tightrope in negotiations. I would have never thought it's a game we would publish until I played it. And I was like, oh my goodness, this game is amazing. And then a little further out next year, Guano, Guano, Guano is an economic game on the history of the guano trade, which in the late 1800s, because there weren't artificial fertilizers, bird shit was actually more valuable by weight than gold. And it made people so this is my favorite. So the richest non-noble in England was actually this guy, Robert Gibbs, and he made all his money he had the monopoly on importing Peruvian bird shit, which was the best bird shit. And so kids on playgrounds would sing, "Mr. Gibbs made his dibs selling the turds of foreign birds." And I'm just like, that's just too good of a story to not have a game about. And then Jason Matthews is finally going to get United States versus Aaron Burr done sometime this year, and we'll put it on Kickstarter sometime next year. So yeah, so we got that's like our first. So by middle of next year, we should have 10 games in print, which is pretty substantial, and we're pretty excited about that.
Yeah, so I mean that's a pretty. So first of all, I was curious when you were going to get to Guano, 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 because I remember you talking about working on the design for it. But I was sort of curious where in that sequence Night Witches was going to land, because that one I've actually played a test copy of. So
I think Night Witches. So I think we're going to switch right now. We have Night Witches as 7 and Peace 1905 as 8, but we might switch those in our numbering system because the Night Witches were Squadron 588. So the 8 kind of sounds cool. And it sort of depends, we'll see. You know, the artwork should be done at the end of June, but do we really want to launch Kickstarter in July? Do we push it? Like, so there's, there's some timing questions, both from a production and a marketing standpoint, that we need to figure out. It would be great to have Night Witches for the holidays this year, but I don't want to promise that unless, everything works out perfectly. So, and things never work out perfectly.
Mike's been around long enough to know that things never work out perfectly. Mike, jump in here. What do you got?
That's like when you start a project at the house, and it's I tell my wife this all the time. One project leads to 5 others. nothing ever goes smooth.
Well, you're retired now. You have all this time to do all these projects.
Yeah, you'd think that. That's one of the biggest scams. It's like everybody says, "Oh, you're retired. You have all this free time." Well, where is it?
Still trying to find it. So Kevin, you've set aside it. We're going to spill the beans a little bit at the risk of overwhelming you at Origins. As when we were putting together the schedule, you specifically asked me to set aside some time for some pitches for people to be able to come and show off their games to you. And you did this last year. We didn't make as big a deal out of it because you didn't tell me specifically to set aside some time. You just sort of found the holes in the schedule and made it known you were there. This time, basically lunch times. We've got you freed up to be able to see stuff from folks. What are the kinds of things you're interested in seeing?
Well, sort of, more of the same from what we've talked about, historical games. They don't need to be war games, certainly. I mean, I would say we have more non-war games than war games, but definitely historically themed, not just themed, but where the decision-making really puts you in the place of the decision-makers at the time, the opportunity to provide a lot of historical documents like we did with Votes for Women. That's something we're definitely embracing. And I found that, I get pitched a lot by email, and people can send me files, and they can send me even prototypes, which is good. It's helpful, but they're just nothing compares to being able to sit down and listen to the passion of the designer, explain the game and play the game with you to really kind of understand, the argument that the designer is making and if it's an interesting game or not, if it's fun, if it's enjoyable, if it's all the things that, we sort of look for in a game. They're not kind of on the schedule yet, but we're publishing Blood and Treasure by Dan Bullock. I was able to see that at Circle DC last year. And same with, that's why we picked up Night Witches and Peace 1905, because I saw those at Circle DC. I saw Land and Freedom and a game on John Burr from Alex Knight. And it's not official yet, but I'm pretty sure I can say that we'll be publishing both the John Brown game and a deluxe version of Land and Freedom, which is just an amazing game. I think David Thompson and I both thought it was the best game of 2023. Land and Freedom is just outstanding. I've never won that game, but, you know, hope springs eternal. It's because I'm too nice of a player. That's the problem. Because I don't want the fascists to win. And then I end up getting put up against the wall by one of my allies in the end of the game. So the thing is, it's really great to be able to play these games in person with the designer, understand the intent. And so there's, you know, I can't be at all conventions, but I'm going to try to make more of an effort to go to a convention, you know, maybe in the Northwest or in Arizona. Obviously, I'm at San Diego Historicon every year. I'm at Circle DC every year, and I'm at Origins every year. So I'm hoping that, you know, wherever I am at a convention, I'll be able to meet folks who appreciate what we're trying to do, appreciate the quality that we're putting into our games, and then, you know, go from there if they have a design that sort of meets what we're looking for.
So yeah. It sounds like, is there a lot of prototyping going on at Circle DC?
Yes. So, gosh, I should take a look at the schedule. I'm not going to go and count through it. That'd be boring. But I think we opened up people to submit schedules today, and I think there's already like 8 different prototypes on there. There's a couple from Non-Breaking Space. Ray Farrell put up a game. I think Sebastian Bay is going to have something there. Plus, you know, Volko will have his game. Tali will have her game. Gilberto and I will have Halsey Montezuma.
When you say Volko will have his game, that's insufficiently specific.
Oh, I'm sorry. Volko actually is going to have several games there. On Friday, he will have Hunt for Blackbeard, and he will be demoing that all day. On Saturday, he'll be doing Coast Watchers, which I believe GMT is publishing. And then on Sunday, you can actually... I approved his events because who says no to Volko, but I don't remember what his Sunday event was. Draken Reconnaissance at Verdun. That's all I know about it. I know nothing about this game. So
interesting.
Sometimes all you need to know is nothing. It's just Volko.
Yep. But if this is a good segue into Circle DC, it's a great event. I mean, of course, I'm going to say that because it's my event. But the standard that I try to meet is what Harold Buchanan does with San Diego. But being in DC, we have a little bit of an advantage. So, you know, Jason Matthews and former Senator Mary Landrieu are giving a tour of the Capitol one morning for people at the convention. Tory Brown and the National Park staff, National Park Service staff, are doing a tour of the Belmont Paul House, and they actually have a copy of Votes for Women there on display. So we have some kind of neat, you know, we call them field trips like that. Of course, there's a field trip to the ballpark on Thursday when the Nationals are playing. But then there's, you know, so many game designers that are going to be there with all their different designs. You know, Jason Matthews, Tori Brown, Volker Runke, Liz Davidson. Elizabeth Hargrave was there last year. She's not joining us this year because she's traveling for the Eclipse. David Thompson, Sebastian Bay, Marie Suckling, Talia, Jason Perez, Dan Bullock, Alex Knight, Akar, who won the Zenobia Awards. I'm trying to think about some new folks coming this year. Cole and Drew Worley will be there. Mark Herman will be there. Harold Buchanan is coming out, so I'm going to have to roll out the red carpet for Harold. And like this is sort of a who's who of at least part of our hobby. And so, you know, it's a really great opportunity to bounce ideas and approaches and even game topics with other folks. So that's why I'm always so excited about it. I've always said that, you know, the favorite convention I attend that is not my own is Harold's, but of course my own is my favorite. So, and there's still 9 tickets remaining. So if someone wants to register, they should.
I think he's talking to you, Mike.
Yeah, I would love to, but that ain't going to happen, unfortunately. I thought I was going this year, but it's not going to happen. I thought you were going, Brad. I thought we were both going to go to this one, honestly.
Well, and I talked to Kevin about this at Gamma Expo, that I've only got so many bullets in the gun I can shoot here for getting away for things. And it was either Gamma Expo or Circle DC. And for us, for our situation, Gamma Expo just made a little more sense for the Dragoons. In part because I thought I had you as backup for Circle DC. And if all else fails, we'll deputize Rocky to take a whole lot of photos for us up there. But Kevin told me I'm not allowed to come anyway, that I'm way too cool for Circle DC, and that Am I getting that right, Kevin?
Something like that, sir. Okay. Something like that.
So
I will say it's not really a media event. I mean, it's really a designer's event. So like we would love to have you, of course, but I actually agree with you that, you know, the Gamma Trade Show makes more sense as far as being able to see more things. And like, it's a little more, that event is a little more aimed at the media. With our event, I mean, we don't even have a logo, and that's on purpose because we're trying to be low key. It's the venue is the Planet Word Museum, which is amazing, super expensive also, and kind of small. And so we're limited to 150, 160 people. And so, you know, we only have 9 left, right? Like I'm actually, you know, we're definitely not begging people to come. We want people who are truly interested in what we're doing to come. And so so we will miss you, but we completely understand.
I would absolutely love to be able to make it just to sit around and play games and, you know, talk to folks about games. It's just, you know, again, when there's only so many bullets you've got in the gun, you got to be judicious about where you shoot.
I'll be honest, that analogy concerns me a little bit, but I'm going to take it and just say maybe next year you can shoot at Circle DC.
The 12th season of Mentions and Dispatches is made possible by all of our Patreon supporters who pledged at the top level. The Armchair Dragoons would like to thank Michael Sundborg, Fred and his dog, Chet Bell, Hellcat 6, Patrick Geraghty, Stagger Wing, Kevin Bertram, Mike Quigley, Martok, and Joseph Knoll for their support of the Regiment of Strategy Gaming, which helps us bring you the best strategy gaming articles, events, and this podcast. You can join us as a Patreon supporter at patreon.com/armchairdragoons.
Look, just because we're blowing you off for DC doesn't mean you can't come hang out with us in October down here for Fall Assembly.
I'll be honest. So, you know, you have demands where you can't travel. I unfortunately have demands where I also have to travel. I coach my daughter's high school debate team, and she's a freshman this year. So for the next 3 school years, it's harder for me. Like, I need to schedule my travel pretty judiciously because I think, you know, there are 12 weekend debate tournaments this year. And I sort of steer the team towards attending the ones that I, you know, to make sure if like there's something I can't, like for example, the Gamma Trade Show, I had to fly back Friday morning so I could be judging debate Friday night. And, you know, it's a hectic schedule. So I'd love to get down to North Carolina, but, you know, maybe some of you folks should come up to Circle DC first as a sign of goodwill.
I'm sure we can manage to get somebody there. Pivoting back to some of the games that are forthcoming. Different companies have different processes they go through for design and development. Some folks are willing to grab basically a good idea and kind of do a bunch of shepherding and development in-house. Some folks want basically done to where you're just sort of polishing up, you know, some edits in the rule books and then get a really good artist to make stuff look cool. There's all over the spectrum in between. Obviously, it's a little bit dependent on who it is bringing something to you. Like you said, you know, if Volko shows up, you're going to listen no matter what because it's Volko. But other folks may not get quite that much latitude. As you're looking at ideas that people are bringing to you, how finished are you expecting them to be when they drop them on a table in front of you? How polished do they need to be? How much does their own visual style they may bring to it matter to you if you're going to turn around and go get another artist to do something anyway? Or are you going to kind of try and stick with what they're bringing? I'm throwing a handful of questions at you. Let's tackle them however you choose there.
Sure. So I would say I don't care what it looks like. I mean, I love Land and Freedom, but like as a game, it's amazing. As a piece of art, I'm fairly critical of it, from the cover to the print on demand style, which, you know, I love Blue Panther. I love using them for prototypes, but that's not the same thing as a final product. And so I guess what I'm trying to say is I don't really care if it looks pretty. I care that the gameplay works, because I think, you know, my first prototype of the Shores of Tripoli, I literally was printing the card text on printer paper and cutting out and that taping that to playing cards, right? That looked terrible, but I was able to play it with people and find out what worked, what didn't. And so that's sort of the focus. So I could care less if it looks good or not. The truth is some people have a natural development streak to them. So Night Witches from David and Liz was 100%, like, they ran all the play testing for it. They basically did all the development. And so all I'm doing now is kind of shepherding the art process with Ian, and I'm involving them quite a bit. So that was almost like a done project dropped on my, you know, doorstep. On the flip side, you know, Votes for Women, Tori's a first-time designer, so there's a lot more development work that I did with her. I coordinated all the playtesting. We, you know, created playtest kits and sent them out to people. You know, there's multiple rounds of revisions. And that was a great process too. And I think the final project was pretty fantastic. I'm very happy how it turned out, but that was just a different process. And, you know, I'm sure Tori's second game will be, you know, it'll probably be a smoother process because now she's went through this process and I've went through this process as a developer, because that was the first time I had developed someone else's game. And so, you know, we both have more experience. And so, you know, that can't help but make the process go easier and quicker and better. And so everything's going to be somewhere in between. You know, the piece 1905 game, right? It was a pretty rough, right? Because it was done for a Consim game jam. Obviously, as they take more time to look at it, they're developing it more. They're adding a solitaire play and a three player, which I didn't think was necessary, but I certainly realized that it'll make it a more sellable game. So happy that they're doing that. And so, you know, it just depends, right? The two games that I'm designing with my wife, obviously, you know, that's a relationship that's been around many years. And so we know how to work together. But it's a different thing, different style than, you know, working with Liz or David or even Jason. So it varies, I guess, is what I'm saying. And it depends on the person, depends on their style. It depends on what their strengths are and what they need.
Yeah. Yeah. Following up to that, as you're looking for artists, obviously you're going to have a couple of folks that you're already sort of comfortable with or have worked with before, or are fans of. As you're taking potential pitches for games, are you also looking for potential pitches for artists or graphic design folks, or do you pretty much have your set stable of who you've got because you know what they do and you like how they do it?
Well, so Mark Rodrigue, who he designed Bayonets and Tomahawks, he did the map for The Shores of Tripoli. He's doing all of the work for Halls of Montezuma. He brought home Votes for Women when Bridget, the main graphic designer, went on maternity leave. And so I have just a lot of faith in Mark, and he sort of understands the stylistic branding that we do. So I can't imagine there will be any project that he doesn't touch at some level. But that being said, you know, it's nice to have a wider group of folks. You know, he's primarily a graphic designer and map guy. For Halls of Montezuma, there were some images that we just didn't like anything from the historical documents. And so we engaged a gentleman named Wouter. Gosh, I can't remember his last name. He's Belgian. He's pretty cool. I love his work. And so he designed some of the images that we used in the Halls of Montezuma cards. Now he's doing some work on the Shakespeare game, and that's great. This is the first time we're working with Ian O'Toole. I would love to continue working with him. He's obviously in high demand, so he can, you know, kind of call his shots. But I would love to, you know, well, we'll see how it goes with Night Witches. But I have a lot of faith in how that's going to go. His work has so far been amazing for everybody he's worked with. But we probably, you know, I wish Bridget had more time for us, but I know that, you know, her sort of focus has changed a bit. So it would be nice to have one or two more folks to fill in. Both, you know, an artist and a graphic designer are not the same thing, even though I kind of use them interchangeably, but they're really not. They're very distinctly different. And, you know, it would be nice to have another graphic designer, and it'd be nice to have another two or three even artists that, you know, can help in the direction of a game. So.
Mike, what else you got, man?
Artists that aren't AI is what you're saying.
Oh, yeah. We're not going to use AI. Like even if I didn't feel strongly about it, which I do feel strongly about it because I think it's theft. But I also, you know, respect that, you know, just from a business standpoint, enough people would be upset with us if we were to use AI art, that it would be a bad decision. So it's both the right thing to do and it's the financially right thing to do to reject AI art. So that's our stance on that.
Yeah, it's scary how fast, not to derail the topic tonight, but it's scary how fast the AI art, the AI in general stuff is coming along. Seems like every week there's a new ad that pops up, you know, hey, try this new AI art generator or something. And it's like, oh my God, where's this all going to end?
I'm kind of a neo-Luddite when it comes to certain things, and that's one of them.
Yeah. I uh,
I'm curious when we're going to start to see not just the AI art, but somebody trying to use a lot of AI written text to start populating game content. I get that some folks have used it as a brainstorming tool, and I'm a little more on the fence about using it as a brainstorming tool. Hey, give me 15 possible somethings, and it spits out 15 somethings, and you go, oh, okay, those three look kind of cool. Let me grab that and go run with it. Like that I could kind of probably get on board with, but hey, write me five paragraphs about this and then copy paste into a game book somewhere. I'm just not so cool with that.
Yeah. You know, I was judging a high school debate round and I caught a kid using ChatGPT during the round to help him with his, with his arguments. And he was reading it on, and the truth is the argument was pretty good. And I was just like, dude, you can't do that. And, you know, I don't know if it violated any rules or not, but it certainly violated my expectations of what kids should be doing in a debate round. And so, you know, that certainly ports over. I mean, you know, what was it? John Henry against the steam engine, steam train. I can't even remember. So, right. Like, you know, I'm rooting for the human. I'm always going to root for the human. And yeah, like let's
yeah, it was John Henry and the steam shovel.
Yeah, so I'm rooting for John Henry.
I think most folks that are currently involved in the creative and publication side of the game business kind of are. I think there's a lot of folks from the outside looking in that think that somehow AI is an appropriate way to lower the barriers to entry.
Well, and I think it's also a generational thing. I think that, you know, I like to think, you know, like I had a computer when I was pretty young. I certainly was adopting, but my digital upbringing was far different than this generation's. And so I think they're probably going to be more comfortable with it. And then the next generation after that would be more comfortable. And hopefully by that time I'll be dead. So it won't really matter to me.
It's funny. You mentioned, you know, I remember the old computer program Eliza. I don't know if you guys ever heard of that or not, but it was basically supposed to be what they were calling AI back in the 80s. And it was this program that it was kind of like a therapist program where you would talk to it and it would kind of just throw back, it would parrot basically what you were saying. But it's just funny to think that how we thought, oh, this might be AI-like, but nowadays it just doesn't even compare to what's going on now. It's crazy.
I think that was even originally programmed like in the 60s.
I think you're right. I think this is a very old program.
Yeah. And then I remember in the 70s, there was a version of it in a book that you could program into your TI-99/4A or your TRS-80.
Yeah.
But that was just, it wasn't learning, right? It didn't.
No.
It didn't, you know. So whereas in war games, if you'll remember, that was what was so great is that Joshua was learning from the games that played previously, which now I'm just outing myself as a big nerd. So maybe I should watch it here. But yeah, so, you know, it's at some point, you know, there's going to be this fast onset of overwhelming mastery by the robots and they'll kill us all. But until then, we're going to lead a happy, wonderful life.
There you go.
You are largely among your fellow nerd friends here, right? I mean, we're doing a podcast on wargaming and, you know, we're talking to a niche publisher within a niche hobby. Yeah, we're all nerds, dude. Don't worry about it. I mean, really.
Hey, we're not going to be niche anymore. We're going to break out that Shakespeare game and the game about shit. Between those two, we're going to go big time.
Looking forward to it.
Hey, you got a game with Teddy Roosevelt coming out. That's the one I'm really waiting on.
Not the one about bird shit?
Well, no. So the funny thing about that one is I live on a river in Virginia, and when we first bought this house, that we had it was about a 1 foot square bush in the backyard, and that's where the wife wanted the bird feeder. Do you know how big that bush is now? It's like it's got a 10-foot radius to it because that's where all the birds, after they're done eating, they just go in the bush and hide. And that bush has grown astronomically in the last 10 years. So I know all about the guano impact and fertilizer.
Yeah, we have the same thing in our backyard. So
and I never would have thought to turn that into a board game though. So that's interesting.
Well, and here's the best thing about it though. And so this was definitely my wife's contribution is she's like, she doesn't really like most of the 18XX, the train games, because you're buying stocks and she thinks that's boring. And even economic games where like the goal is to have the most money at the end, that's kind of boring. And so in Guano, 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 the way you win is not by having money. It's by buying cool Gilded Age, ridiculous baubles. And that's where you get your points. But you have to sort of, it's kind of like a work-life balance, right? Because that means you're not making more money. You're now spending your money, but you get your joy. Like it's just going to be cool. You're just going to have to trust me on that one.
We have no choice but to trust you, don't we?
I guess so.
So you've got your wife designing one. How long till you've got your daughter designing one?
So my daughter is very into linguistics, and we've been discussing a game about the history of language and how to make it interesting, because college applications are pretty competitive. But if you're trying to go to a school to study linguistics and you've designed a game that you can buy at Barnes and Noble about linguistics, I figure that might give her a leg up on an application process. So we're talking about it. We'll see if it gets done before she has to apply to college.
I would suspect it can't hurt.
That is my suspicion as well.
Backing up slightly to Gamma Expo, because this is something that I asked of the folks that we recorded while we were there. What did you see at Gamma Expo, or a session you attended, or something you went and saw, or even something you presented at, if you did? I don't think you were on the list for folks to present somewhere, but what was something you saw that was particularly cool or caught your eye or you thought was pretty neat?
So this is terrible. I didn't go to any sessions. I didn't go to any panels. And I also didn't walk very much of the floor. I just would go to my booth. I happened to be next to the trekking history people and the Choose Your Own Adventure books. So I really liked the people on either side of me. I chatted with them quite a bit. And that was, about the best part of the show proper. And then, but the dinners were the best part, right? Like I said, one night we went out with Queen and some other folks, and that was great. And, Jason and I went out with Drew and Cole Worley, and we chatted about the industry. And, Worley Gig is a similar, I would say they're the company that we probably identify most with, even though their games are a little more difficult than ours and a little bit different bent. But like they take the history seriously. History is, the games are making an argument, and not only Cole designs, but now the new games that they're working on. And so it's really nice to share how best to run a company that are when the companies are at the size that they are. And Drew basically runs that company, and Cole is sort of the talent. And over here, I run the company, and Jason isn't quite the same level of involved as the talent, but he's definitely the one with an eye for things. And so there's that kind of left brain, right brain partnerships at both companies. That's interesting to watch. And so, so that was really valuable. As far as like listening to some, consultant who's trying to sell us services, talk to me for 45 minutes about whatever he's trying to pitch, that's not really super interesting to me, I have to be honest. That make me sound kind of like a cynic. So maybe that's bad.
Well, so I attended one or two of the sessions last year, and then a couple of them this year also. The ones that are essentially your peers, just trying to help out other publishers, I think those are probably a little more, or I would think they'd be a little more interesting than, like you said, some consultant up there trying to sell you on a service. But I think if you've got somebody else running another business of comparable size to yours, saying, hey, here's some things that I learned about how to do stuff. Those might be ones that would help here and there. You're probably beyond needing to attend the help, I accidentally became a game publisher session, which I think is actually the title of one of them from this year. But last year I did go to Jeff Tidball's talk on project management for, I don't remember the exact wording, but it was something like project management for impetuous visionaries and the easily distracted. And that was actually pretty, look, I'm a project manager for my day job. I have been for, almost a decade now, but I still, got a couple of good insights from Jeff's talk about project management in the game business.
Oh, I'm sure there'd have been things I could learn. I don't mean to say that. I just, you never know which ones are going to be great and which ones aren't. And so I just hung out in the hall for the most part. So, I don't mean to poo-poo people are trying to, like, I actually have a blog where I talk about the business of running the company. I share numbers. I'm like, this is how much money we made last year. This is what we spent our money on. This is what our profit or loss was. I just posted a discussion about fulfillment and what the costs are using Amazon or using someone like Quartermaster or another third party, or doing self-shipping. And like those things I find very interesting. I usually, though, find it much more interesting to read them than listen to someone tell me about them. And I'm not sure why that is. It's just probably my learning style. So I like, you know, I do the way I like to learn, which is reading. So, you know, I write it so other people can read it. I'm sure there are some great panels. So I didn't mean to indicate that they're not. It's just, I used to work in the tech industry and so many panels I would go to were just worthless. And so I sort of kind of soured on those kind of things.
Yeah. So you jumped ahead to where I was going to go toward the end of this year, which was you've got a blog where you kind of hike up the skirt a little bit and let folks in on what's going on behind the doors. And you lay out a lot of things that I think would make a lot of other companies nervous for them to share.
Well, yeah, I guess. So I really like Jimmy Stegmaier did this to a degree. There's a gentleman, James Math, who unfortunately passed away, who did this to a degree. Even Steve Jackson Games would do like a shareholder or a stakeholder report every year. And I really found all of those valuable. But the thing that I found frustrating is they mostly didn't share actual numbers. I mean, occasionally they would, but like there was enough that you couldn't get the full picture. And so, you know, I decided that it would be worth it to share the full picture, right? Like here is what you... Here's what we've done. And, you know, you might be better at running your company, you might be worse, but you're going to get at least a ballpark of what happens, right? Like because I have access to capital, I can run the company a little looser and have higher expenses. But if I was, you know, if capital was more constrained, then I would probably run a tighter ship than I do, right? But regardless, I'm still trying to do things efficiently and, you know, walking through what those decisions are, whether it's on production, whether it's on fulfillment, whether it's on, you know, what price point that we're trying to hit and therefore how much we can, you know, how much a production should cost. You know, all of those questions I think are really important for publishers to know about going into it. Otherwise, you know, you can, you know, lose a lot of money and, or, you know, you see a lot of Kickstarter campaigns that don't fulfill because they're run by people who probably maybe shouldn't be running businesses. They might be great creative talents, but just don't quite understand how to do the basics of blocking and tackling. And so, you know, I certainly am more on the side. I'm not particularly creative. I don't think I'm actually a particularly innovative game designer. Well, there's one or two things I've been proud of, little things that I've done, especially in Halls of Montezuma. But in general, like I recognize where my skill set is. My skill set is logistics and finance and accounting and making sure, you know, and coming up with some creative marketing and a commitment to his, like, those are the things that I'm good at. And so, you know, I try to pass on whatever lessons I've learned, and those lessons mean more if there's actual dollar numbers attached to them. So if you say, oh, this is a pretty good way to make money, or this is a pretty good way to do this, doesn't mean the same thing as, yeah, if we ship from Amazon, it's going to cost $12 a game to deliver. If we ship through a third party, it used to only cost $15, but now it costs $23. And that's probably cost prohibitive, right? Like that's putting real meat on the discussion, which I just think is helpful. So,
yeah, absolutely. Mike, what did we miss?
I don't know. I think we've hit about everything. We could talk. Have we talked about upcoming conventions that we're all going to be at? Or
well, Origin, since you know you and I are bailing out on him for Circle DC. Beyond that, probably Origins of 2025. I'm going to try to make Circle DC in 2025.
I appreciate that. You know, I've never been to Gen Con, and I don't think I'm ever going to go to Gen Con. I'd like to go to Essen, but probably not this year. Maybe wait till next year when we have enough titles to justify it. And you should, if you can't, I mean, you should go to Circle DC first, but after that, you should go to one of Harold Buchanan's events, either the one in San Diego, and you know, Rhode Island. Diego in November is awesome, or Rhode Island in August. Now, I'll never go to the August one because I'm always traveling with my family in August. So, or at least for the next several years, I won't be making that one. But the one in San Diego is outstanding. And, you know, it's San Diego in November and it's beautiful. So it's hard to beat that.
Yeah. I'd love to go to the Rhode Island one. You go to the San Diego and I'll try to go to the Rhode Island one.
Got it covered then.
San Diego is tough to beat any time of year, really. But
yeah, it really is.
Particularly, you know, for folks that are sort of north of the Mason-Dixon line, San Diego in November has a particular attraction. So, because that's the challenge you run into is that November is still college football season. And you know, while San Diego has a team or two, they're not really the heavy hitters. So,
yeah, you know, oddly, it's very strange. So I went to the University of Arizona. We had an outstanding basketball team when I was there. We had a pretty good football team. I mean, our defense was outstanding. And I used to like every weekend college football and, you know, Thursday and Saturdays watching college basketball. And now, like, with all the conference mergings and the weird, like, the Pac-12 network, I couldn't get out here in DC. And now I just don't care anymore. Like, I just... Yeah. Don't care about college football anymore. And I know that's kind of sad.
Yeah. I'm with you in terms of all the mergers and realignments and unlimited transfers and dollars flying all over the place and whatever else, that it's not the game we grew up with.
No, definitely not. And I missed the Pac-10, right? 10 teams. Yeah. You played each team in the conference. So you play all, you know, you play 9 conference games and 2 non-conference games. It was awesome, right?
Dude, I started at an ACC school when there were only 8 teams in the league.
Yeah, and that was awesome, right? I mean, that's the way it should be. So, see, this
they
is
added
another way.
After I got there, that's how long ago it's been.
Of course, this is just us being, you know, nostalgic for the old times.
We are curmudgeons.
They might as well just put us in the old folks' home.
If you want some of those old times, so I went to a college that's a Division II NCAA football. Watch those games. Those are good.
Yeah, you know, I found when watching like English soccer, the championship, which is the second division, or even like further down, like the third and fourth division, those matches are awesome and the crowds are great. Whereas, you know, the first division matches are, you know, the Premier League matches, they're a little, you know, although I just went to a match in Liverpool. I was in London a couple weeks ago and then I took the train up to Liverpool and that was an amazing experience. So I shouldn't say that because that was awesome too.
Well, like, it's kind of you know, I love baseball, but I really love watching minor league baseball in person. Those games are awesome.
Yeah. My wife and I used to, like, wherever we'd go, we'd try to catch a minor league baseball game, but
yeah, you know, yeah,
we're a little older now. We just don't quite do that as much, but I have season tickets for the Washington Nationals and my seats are rather good and I love going to games there. So I try to go to about 12 or 15 games a year. And
I haven't been to a Nationals game since they've changed the baseball rules.
Oh, it actually kind of, well, oh, hello. Sorry, my computer just went to sleep, but I'm still here. I don't love the rule changes, but having some of those games over quicker, I don't know. I'm kind of torn about it. Like, yeah. It is kind of nice. So I'm not sure how I feel about it.
I haven't been to one since the rules changes, but that's been more lack of opportunity than lack of willingness, just because we don't have a major league team near us here. And it's a little tougher to get to one.
Yeah. So. Are you closer to Atlanta or DC?
It depends. It depends on where we're marginally closer to DC, but it depends on where in the area you're trying to get to, because to get like down into Nationals ballpark through a lot of the DC halo, can actually take longer than getting to parts of Atlanta, even though Atlanta is really about an hour further away.
That's so fair.
Kevin, is there anything we didn't ask you that we should have asked you?
No, I think we covered it. I got to, you know, rave about all our games, talked about the blog, come to Circle DC. So I don't know what else there is. I think that's about the size of it.
So to recap, we've got Votes for Women coming in soon-ish.
May.
Halls of Montezuma shortly thereafter.
June.
And I guess Shores of Tripoli, is that reprint going to go through before things like Blackbeard start to show up?
I'm not sure. We haven't run the campaign for Blackbeard. And I'm not sure how many we're going to end up printing because I want to see how the campaign goes. And then I'm not sure if I'm going to do a campaign for Tripoli or not. This actually is kind of interesting. So because we're going to do a new box, you know, a lot of people who already bought Shores of Tripoli, you know, will want an upgrade kit. And I'm like, how do I make an upgrade kit? I might as well just send them a new game. But like, what's the cheapest I can charge and not lose too much money? So I'm not really sure. We might do a campaign for sure Tripoli, but would just have a really low price point, like $25 a game. And that's really aimed at people who have bought the game before. And if some new people buy the game, that's fine too. It's, you know, it's kind of a loss leader to introduce folks to our games. So so we'll see how that goes. And then the Shakespeare game has to be here in June because that's when the Folger Shakespeare Library opens. So even if I have to airmail 300 games here, so they have them for the opening, they'll be here in June. And then, you know, everything kind of flows from there. So
yeah, I just the Blackbeard versus Shores of Tripoli timing was a little vague because you had mentioned putting the, you know, numbering the games, putting the three on the Tripoli box.
Yeah. So. Well, and I also like, you know, like I say, they're not exactly sequential. Yeah. I just like Halls of Montezuma, Shores of Tripoli being, you know, two and three because that matches the song. So
yes. Yep. That it totally makes sense. Absolutely. So cool. Well, for as folks are listening to this, Circle DC is probably going to be sold out, but is still in the future as folks are listening to this. But if you want to come see stuff from Fort Circle, they've got two tables with us at Origins in the Wargame HQ this year. And so we're going to have a combination of Shores of Tripoli, Halls of Montezuma, Votes for Women, First Folio. And I think we've even got a Blackbeard session or two on the schedule. Yep. There.
I'm not nearly as good at teaching it as Volko, but you know, I can suffer through.
You can try and get him to show up. Like I can get him a GM badge.
No, Volko is like a souffle. You have to be very delicate.
Fair enough. And then again, we are holding some time open for Kevin for basically lunch times, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, for folks to show up and make a pitch. If you've got something that you think fits what Kevin has been describing today, and you know, listen a little earlier where he's being a little more deliberate about these are the kinds of things we're looking for, come shoot your shot, man. You know, if you don't show your stuff off to him, it's an automatic no.
Yeah. And you know, what I should have done is when you ask what kind of games I'm looking for, these are the games I wish I printed. Land and Freedom, Watergate, The Hunt, Match of the Century, Battle of Versailles, the one about the
fashion shows.
Show. Like those are all right kind of in our wheelhouse of kind of things. And then, you know, a little bit, I don't want us to stray too far away from our war game roots. I'd like to have a couple more war games in the hopper. Obviously, more on the lighter side, more on the introductory side, the way Shores of Tripoli is. Halls of Montezuma is only, you know, a half step up in difficulty from Shores of Tripoli. So, you know, definitely in that playable, but yet interesting space is what we're looking for.
Yeah, yeah. Cool. Audience, thank you for joining us tonight. Mike, Kevin, thank you guys for being here. And Kevin, especially for staying up past your bedtime.
Oh my goodness, I'm so tired.
And that first podcast after daylight savings time always kicks your ass.
Definitely.
And you know, audience, thank you for being here. As we're about halfway through season 12 here of Mentioned and Dispatches, and we'll keep wrapping it up. We've got a couple of them that are a little more professional practitioner focused over the next few weeks, and then we're going to get around to talking Charles S. Roberts Awards, talking summer convention stuff, and we're going to take a look at kind of the state of hobby wargaming toward the end of this season also. So we hope you'll come back and join us for another episode in the future, and thanks for listening to Mentioned and Dispatches.